You quote from some of the press coverage. Tell us about that and what kind of effect that had.
Well, I think it was interesting because Baltimore had at least three newspapers, The Sun, The Gazette, The Record. Martinsburg had a paper. This was covered internationally. And London came over. Reporters from New York were here. And those have been preserved. And I give Ed Papenfuss a huge amount of credit. And
he is the retired archivist, right?
Uh-huh. Because a lot of that stuff is online. And it makes it so much easier to do the kind of research that you need to do. And it, what I try to do was to show a totality of life. And so one of the chapters talks about classified ads, which were in the Sun at that time. And it shows people trying to live a normal life while the city was under military occupation. That is, they were looking for places to live. Some people were buying false teeth, looking for hired servants, refusing to accept their spouse's debts, things like that.
But the position that so many newspapers took toward the strike,
very hostile,
seemed to be very much allied with the railroads.
Yes, very much so. And so that, as a historian, you have to look at this with some care. On the other hand, they provide vivid descriptions, almost minute by minute, of activities here in Baltimore. And so one of the things that I did in the book was to include a lot of verbatim material. And I thought, oh, I should summarize this or dramatize that. A previous historian had done that. And I thought, no, I think it speaks for itself. I think it's dramatic as it is.
You write about the extraordinary solidarity in Baltimore. You seem to have the impression that there was greater solidarity among workers, not just railroad workers, I think, in Baltimore than in many other cities. Why?
Well, I don't know that it was more. For example, in Martinsburg, in smaller towns, which were almost exclusively railroad towns, the solidarity was huge. And they would even release people from jail in Martinsburg. Here, I think it was just a sense of everybody had suffered during the Depression. And if you look at the 1930s, for example, you just find a kind of sense of we're all in this together, and here's a group that is standing up and not going to take any more pushing, and we're going to help them out. Their families, many of the people in the National Guard, we will see as the Guard is brought over to the Camden Station, within a day they're supposed to occupy the station, most of them have disappeared. They have friends bring in changes of clothing. They go in the bathroom or in a saloon. They change their clothes and just disappear. So by the beginning of the second week, there are ads in the Sun for recruiting more people into the National Guard. And there are notes to employers saying, please allow your people the time off to come, because employers who were working were upset because their workers were gone for a week full time. And many of them were just bivouacked at Camden Station.
What is the long-term legacy of the 1877 railroad strike?
Well, I think one long-term legacy is the establishment of collective bargaining for unions in this country. And I think, as I said, you look at the history of railroad unions, the passage of laws during the First World War, and into the 20s, they were the first union to get true collective bargaining with government support. And at a time when the steel industry, for example, in 1919, the steel workers were being killed, the railroad workers were established. And it became the first national industry. So they became the first national unions, as opposed to groups that we see in Baltimore, the little box makers and the can makers, who were very local and small enterprises. But I think the establishment of benefit funds by the unions still exists today. And the sense, one of the things that you see in the book in the aftermath is that everybody from the President of the United States down to the railroad workers is figuring out what's this country going to look like? And I think that's exactly the question that we're facing today, because you had a group of very wealthy, powerful people, a working class, large immigrant numbers, poorly paid, wage cuts, things like that. And how should they be treated? Should they be allowed to have organizations of their own? Should the government support those organizations? Should they fight them? Should they bring out military force against them? And we see, as recently as last week, for example, the governor of Maryland getting involved in contract negotiations at Johns Hopkins, not certainly bringing out the National Guard, but encouraging the people not to strike and sit down and work your differences out. And I think that that is a reflection of exactly the same issues that we see in 1877. You know, what's the government going to do in relation to the workers' right to collectively bargain and organize?
What prompted you to get involved with sponsoring a highway marker about the 1877 strike at Camden Yards?
Well, I think, just as we've been talking about here, Sheila, people learn from history, and it needs to be visible. And I've been a big supporter of Maryland History Day. We offer a labor history prize to young students who do it. And interestingly enough, I had five or six from around the country contact me about the 1877 strike. And I've two young people who I did not get to meet drove all the way from Joplin, Missouri to the B&O Museum.
Which is in what was the Mount Clair station.
Right here. And they saw the curator, Dave Shackelford, down there. But so you learn how people dealt with the problem in the past, and it hopefully illuminates how you're going to deal with it today. And so many of the issues of 1877, how do you deal with a declining economy? How do you deal with huge monopolies, things like that, are, I think, very important. And so I taught labor history, and I said I think it needs to be visible. We are working on a historical marker at Sparrows Point, and it's somewhere in the queue at the Maryland Historical Trust, because that's an area that unfortunately is gone and needs to be remembered. And I just thought that the strike was very important. There is only one other historical marker in Maryland for working class people, and that is a memorial to Mother Jones down in Prince George's County at a nursing home where she used to live. And so it was a wonderful event. And we had an unveiling and a big party and activities in March of last year. And it's, as I said, it's still there. Every time I go to the baseball game, I stop by and see it.
What should people know about this strike?
That it was huge, and it was like a national strike. And as I said before, this is like 10 books in one, because it's about government policy. You have a president of the United States who should or should not be in office. And if you have, remember your American history, the election of Rutherford B. Hayes was hotly contested. And there were some people who referred to him as the alleged president of the United States.
Where have we heard that?
Yes. John Garrett, on the other hand, addresses him as Your Excellency in all his letters. And so the role of the government, the role of the unions, the role of industry, the role of local officials, the militia, public welfare. How should workers be treated? Should there be a safety net, which there wasn't at the time? What about immigration? What about Baltimore as an economic center? And this is exactly the discussion we're having now about the port and the widening of the Panama Canal, things like that. Because Baltimore had been a big port city in the early 1800s and was threatened with oblivion by the creation of the canal system. And so Alexander Brown, of Alex Brown and Company, went to England, saw this newfangled thing called a train, and got everybody together in 1827 and said, hey, we have one of these. We won't worry about the canals. We'll be back in business. And that's what happened. It's about immigrants. It's about the Germans. It's about the Irish. It's about the communities. There's a great museum, the Irish Railroad Workers Shrine, across from the B&O that Tom Ward and his group started. And it's a museum that is a row house. It was owned by a family who father and son worked at the B&O. As far as we can see, they didn't participate in the strike. But it's furnished as if it were a strike, a immigrant house. And you even have voice-activated dialogue as you walk into it. And here's what people were talking in the 1870s. St. Peter the Apostle Church, which is now gone, but that was the parish church just up the street in West Baltimore in the Poppleton area. So there was just an enormous amount of history. And the contrast, for example, until the Irish Railroad Workers Shrine started, the only memory of the B&O was the John Garrett Mansion. And that's a symbol of the Gilded Age.
That's the mansion at...
On Charles Street, Evergreen House.
Evergreen House.
Yeah, with 3,000 books and gold-plated bathroom fixtures and stuff. And while he's cutting the pay for the railroad workers, he's in the process of buying that for his son. So it's a... There are visual memories of Baltimore, and it's what people think our city is and what its identity is and what should be remembered.
Thank you.
Thank you.